How's that?
I think
one day
I feel so.
Well, look, thank you.
Now, what would be my story if that were the case?
Oh, no. So, that's not what I meant.
You can, but I can't answer it.
And there was this indescribable welter of emotions.
I think
to this day,
I will never accept
it. Was
that.
Like something that
never
just sort of snapped in my head.
And
look, I don't know. It's a miracle.
And I hope that the people listening to us will enjoy what they hear.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Last year at a ceremony, I briefly met a woman called Narita Morsudiop. One part of me is always looking at guests for you for this program, and I suspected Narita had a great story. And, well, here it is in a nutshell. Narita was born and raised on Thursday Island. She was recruited into a religious cult as a teenager. She escaped from the cult with her kids, lived in a caravan park and cooked for everyone, became an Avon lady. A chance encounter with an African student inspired Narita to study. Now she has a PhD in criminal justice and social work, and she's off to Canada to investigate the incarceration of Indigenous people. Hi, I've had a dull old life, haven't I, compared to you, it sounds like. Hello.
Hi.
Now, you were born and raised on Thursday Island. Thursday Island, it's a small place, you know, physically, but it's kind of bursting with culture, isn't it? Because I've been told that there's not only, of course, Torres Strait Islander people there are Polynesian people there, there are Japanese pearl divers, descendants of missionaries. It's a pretty lively place, isn't it?
Yes, it is, actually. It's a very multicultural place. We have all the different cultures there all together, all living together in harmony, I guess. Yeah, it's a beautiful little island, and it sits between Tuesday Islets, Wednesday Island and Friday Island.
All right. So, I figure there should be the rest of the days of the week there. Can you give me a picture of your family home, the one you grew up in?
My family home was built by my grandfather at the back of the island, and it only had two rooms, and where my grandparents and I was raised with my two brothers and a sister. No running water, no electricity, we didn't even have a fridge, and we would have to walk down the road to get water from the well to wash our clothes by hand, and we had to walk up the hill to get firewood for our stove because we had a wood stove, and also too, we had the drinking water was from the rainwater that we had a couple of 44-gallon drums to collect the drinking water and stuff, and my grandfather was an avid gardener and would plant all manner of tropical vegetables and fruits and bananas and mangoes and custard apples and, you know, and stuff. So I kind of, even though I lived in a house that was, you know, we didn't have the modern conveniences, but we would catch fish and we would eat fresh fish during the day. I mean, all the time. And we, because my grandparents were elderly, people would bring food to them, you know, whatever they had, you know, turtle or dugong or whatever they'd bring to us and stuff. And, you know, my grandparents were very, very respected in my local community and raised as well and in a beautiful, peaceful household.
So given there's no PowerPoints to plug in an Xbox or a DVD player, what do you do for fun?
We used to play cards and we created our own games. We had marbles. We used to, climb trees. And,
music, big part of it?
Yeah, we all used to bring out the guitar and the ukulele, and I guess we would sing and stuff. And, you know, and the whole island, you know, the people was just bustling with activity. You know, there was always some wedding happening or some tombstone unveiling happening, and people would be just they'd be dancing and singing and all of that kind of stuff. And when they would have a feast, the whole island would be in, the whole community would be invited, basically. Everyone in Tamworth would be invited to come along. Yeah, no, we always had lots of fun. We'd go fishing as children. We would catch the fish and we would just cook it down there and eat that. And then we'd collect beech almonds and raid somebody's sweet potato garden.
Fantastic. Sounds really lovely because it sounds like paradise, what you're talking about here.
Yes, it was, you know, and like you don't really appreciate the place you live in while you're there. But when you leave and you go away and you come back and you think, wow, you know, this is where I grew up. And when I show people, you know, like pictures of my island and everyone go, oh, no wonder you're the way you are. You know, like, you know, I'm basically a happy person. You know, I'm very optimistic.
That's nice. Normally you kind of resent it when people say, oh, that's why the way you are, don't you? But that's nice.
Yeah.
Your grandfather sounds like a really lovely man. Tell me more about him.
Well, he was the son of a Rutuman pearl diver. Rutuma is an island about 300 miles north of Fiji. The island was annexed by Fiji. They're Polynesian people. And his father went up to the Torres Strait to dive for pearls during the pearling industry and married a Torres Strait Islander woman up there. But he died when my grandfather was quite young. But my grandparents basically, raised, us children.
Did you speak English at home?
No, we didn't speak English at home. I didn't know how to speak English. I learned, went to school to speak. I learned English in school.
So what did you speak at home?
Torres Strait Creole, because my grandfather really wanted us to master the English language because he was a visionary and he could see that in order for us to do well in the world, we needed to be able to master the English language because he could see that for us to get a better job. And he would say stuff like he would really enforce us studying really hard, and we had only a hurricane lamp, a small hurricane lamp to study by. And he would say, look, we didn't have the opportunities that you have. You have to study, in order for you to make it in the world, I guess. And he would always push that. And when I was little also, my grandmother would read stories to me. Because my grandmother, her story is a little bit different. She, because she had health issues, major health issues, and so she was sent up to Cherbourg. And she lived in Cherbourg for quite a while. And because she had left the island and came down to Cherbourg, she learned to speak, a bit of English and stuff. So she was able to read stories to me, read storybooks and stuff. And where when I was little, I would memorize, all the nursery rhymes, even though I didn't really know what the words are, but I knew how to, say the nursery rhymes. And then I learned, when I went to school, then I learned English at school. Because I was born in the 60s and grew up in the 60s and 70s, so this was the days where anyone caught speaking their own language was sent to the office to be caned. Kids were actually segregated in the sense that...
You were beaten for speaking your own language at school?
Well, not me myself, but a couple of my friends and relatives actually were sent to the office to be caned if they were caught speaking their own language in the classroom or in the schoolyard. Those were kind of the rules that was enforced, I guess, at that time. And we actually thought that it was about us being able to learn the English language properly.
Yeah,
But
beating you into an enjoyment of the English language.
Yeah, so those were kind of the days. And I always grew up with this terrible inferiority complex.
Why?
Well, because I never thought that I could make it, as better as my Anglo-Australian counterpart, because they could read English really well. Because we had a couple of non-Indigenous students in with us in the classroom, because their parents actually worked up in the Torres Strait, and they would always be able to read well, and they spoke English well. And then I thought, these people are smarter, these kids are smarter and stuff. So I never ever saw myself, on their level. But, I went to Thursday Island Primary School and to Thursday Island High School. But in those days, we didn't go up to grade 11 and 12. So when we got to grade 10, then we kind of had to leave the island and either go to Cairns, or some of the kids came further down south, like to Charters Towers or Brisbane.
What did you want to do with your life, Narita?
When I was like 14, 15, I was actually thinking about becoming a nun.
Yes,
but
we'd be having a very different conversation now, wouldn't we? If you'd become a nun.
No, but it was my auntie, or she was one of my mums, because I was raised by so many of these really strong women that I called them all my mums. They're all my mums, and so I was raised by one of my mums, and it was her husband, who was Anglo-Australian actually, and he said to me, "Oh no, you don't want to become a nun," He sort of said, quickly drummed it out of my head, saying, no, you don't want to do that. Then I thought, maybe blue nurses, being a blue nurse would be really great, because they actually cared for people. And I read something about them in some magazine or something that I was reading, and I thought, these people are cool, maybe I'd be a blue nurse.
So then you moved to Cairns, and in Cairns you joined a cult, a religious cult. How were you recruited into that cult, Narita?
I went down to go to finish my schooling, and so I went to Cairns Business College, and I did it, and I got a diploma of secretarial studies. But while I was a student there, I bumped into some Jesus people, as they call themselves, Jesus people of North Queensland, and I bumped into them in the streets. And because I saw that they were young, they were vibrant, and my grandfather, going back, my grandfather was a very religious man. And so he used to pray and encourage us to pray and stuff. And so I kind of grew up not only in the Anglican church, but I also with the Assembly of God church. So when I met these young Christians...
Indicating you're making the quotation mark around the word Christian here.
Yeah, yes. That I thought, these people are really cool, and And I wanted to hear more about what they had to say. So they gave me a Jesus tract, like a pamphlet, and they were telling me about their group and stuff.
So they invited you to a meeting?
One of them invited me to come to his baptism. And us girls stayed in 22 Jones Street in Westcourt, and our house mother was Mrs. Bonnie Simpson. She was our house mum. And, you know, she really was a beautiful lady and really treated us well and stuff. And I used to stay back to help her with the dishes and stuff. So one day I walked back later, and that's when I bumped into the Jesus people. And one of the guys said, look, I'm going to be baptized on Sunday. Would you like to come? And I said, oh, yeah, sure, you know. But then on Sunday I had other things to do, and so I never went. So I thought, oh, you know, I was feeling bad. So I thought, oh, I'll go down and just say to them, because I knew where the coffee shop was. They had a coffee shop in Cairns. It was this where they gave out free coffee, and they had, like, you know, fishing nets up, and it was like, and the cushions on the floor and dim lights and stuff. You know, this is back in the 70s, you know. And so I went and tried to find Meshach, because all the people in the group all took on biblical names, and this guy's name was Meshach. And so I went to see Meshach, but I ended up bumping into Daniel Hallelujah. He was the leader of the group, and he was the one.
Daniel Hallelujah was his name.
Yeah, and he was the leader of the group, and he was the one that kind of came and started talking to me. But I didn't actually got right into it. Like, I went to a couple of meetings with them, but then I kind of, after I finished my diploma, I ended up working for a public accountant in Cairns for a little while.
Now, this group, did you, the Jesus people, as they were called, did you think at the time that they were kind of like a regular, you know, evangelical Christian organization? Did you know that you were sort of making contact with something that is, to all intents and purposes, a cult?
Well, actually, when they started off, they were a regular group, because they were connected to the Assembly of God Church. Like, we would go along to some of the meetings with the Assembly of God Church and stuff, and so I was familiar with that. Like, when I finished my Diploma of Secretarial Studies, I kind of went to Townsville for a little bit, and that's when I met my husband in Townsville, my first husband, and then we went to Sydney. And then from Sydney, we came back again, and we came to Cairns. And he was also a Christian, so he was very interested in this group, because I was telling him about this group, and he was interested. But I kind of didn't really want to join the group. But I just wanted to be, you know, like, see them every now and again, because I was kind of wanting to do because I was working as a secretary for a public accountant, James Grock.
Yeah. Being just casually associated with a cult, that just doesn't happen, does it?
Yeah, because my husband made contact with them, and but we weren't married. He was my fiance at that time, and then we ended up joining the group. And because he said, oh, he wanted to join the group. And I remember talking with the wife of the public accountant and about joining this group, and she was saying, don't do that, don't throw your life away. And she kept on saying to me, don't do that, you know. And then I said, oh, no, you know, this is what I want to do. And the last thing she said to me was, you can't reason with a 17-year-old. And she was just shaking her head. You can't reason with a 17-year-old, you know. And I just wish I could see Mrs. Grock again and say, look, you were right.
Okay, there are going to be a few important life lessons today. That is the first one of them. You can't reason with a 17-year-old. So having joined the group, what did that mean? Where did you go with your fiancé?
Well, the group, we ended up getting married in the group. The group organized our wedding, so we got married. So I got married at 18. And we didn't call them communes. We called them kibbutz. They were like Christian kibbutz. I don't know if you can have something like that.
Right, the Jewish name, like kibbutz.
Yes, and so the one in Cairns was called Shalom Kibbutz. And there was another one in Atherton Tablelands called Yom Kibbutz. Yom means day. You know, of course, Shalom is peace. Well, you know, that's the basic word for it. And then we had a farm, 80 acres up in outside of Herberton, in the Atherton Tablelands, you know, outside of Herberton.
So you were there with your husband on this farm?
I was not only I was in different places. I was, because we had like a relocation where everybody would be sent to different places, because there was like 40 people in the group when I was there from all over the world. And a lot of us, you know, you might get all of us there together under the one roof, or you might get 20 at a time or 10 at a time.
So, Narita, how did you spend your day on the kibbutz?
We lived to a timetable, especially like we would wake up at 6 in the morning, then we would go for a mile run, we would come back and we would do exercise, and then we wouldn't have breakfast. We would just have like fresh fruits and tea and coffee and stuff, and then we would go out. We would either do Bible studies or we would actually go and do street witnessing. But every member of the group only had a medium-sized backpack that contained all of their clothing and their everything that they owned. So we kind of lived according to the, you know, Acts 2:44 and 45 of the New Testament of the Bible, where it says, and all that believed were together and had all things in common, and they sold their possessions and goods and parted them to all men as every man had need. And so we kind of lived like that and tried to live. I guess the philosophy was a good one in the term of caring and sharing. But the leader of the group, you know, he kind of had other ideas. But like on the farm, we actually had, you know, a 2-acre garden where we planted everything you would find in the vegetable shop except for African artichokes.
Was everyone equal in the group?
Well, yes and no. People were treated okay, but then the women had a different role. And women were kind of kept barefoot and pregnant, and women kind of really didn't have a voice much to speak. But I guess it depended on the partner of the women, the husbands of the women. And all the married women, you know, they kind of stayed with their husband in a separate place. And then the single women all slept in bunk beds, and the single men was in a different room, and the single men slept in bunk beds in a different room as well.
Religious cults tend to have a few things in common. One thing is that they gather their people around them somewhere in the countryside, isolated from the outside world. You were pretty isolated from the outside world, apart from when you went street witnessing.
Well, in Bethel we were, but not in Cairns, not in Atherton. We were actually there, right in the city, because it was about proselyting.
Okay.
It was about going and witnessing to people. And
the second thing is, people tend to become sleep deprived, because the less sleep you have, the more tired you are all the time, and the less willing you are to question things. And the third thing is, cult leaders tend to want to run the sex lives of their followers pretty quickly. Did that happen to the Jesus people?
Yes, I guess the leader of a group suddenly decided that he wanted to. He brought in the doctrine of polygamy.
Oh yeah,
because he kind of studied the.
Why
the
am
Testament.
I not surprised, Narita?
Yeah. He kind of studied the Old Testament, really, you know, and he found that, you know, the prophets of God all had, like, you know, more than one wives and concubines and things like that. And he kind of brought in the doctrine of polygamy.
Polygamy for every male, or just for himself?
Actually, for everybody, but he was intent on, you know, yeah, having, I guess, several partners.
What were you taught to believe about outsiders, people who weren't part of your group?
Outsiders were basically all going to hell. They were not real Christians, and the ones in church were called lukewarm Christians.
Gee, that's a lot of dead bodies on Judgment Day, isn't it? There's only, what, 40 people saved and the rest of the planet burns in flames? Is that how it was? Really? Seriously, that's what you were being told. So I suppose the stakes are pretty high then for you, aren't they?
Yeah, well, see, we weren't allowed to have any newspapers or radios or television. We didn't read any of that. We didn't look at any of that. And I don't know whether the leader of the group did, but I didn't really see him reading any newspapers or anything. Yeah.
You mentioned you were married. What kind of pressure did the group's leader put on your marriage?
He wanted me to be one of his concubines, I guess, one of his wives. And and so he was the one that got rid of my husband. And
how did he get rid of your husband?
Oh, he just said that he was not, he was unstable. And I was young, you know, and I don't really know, like, the full details of that. But he kind of then wanted, he said, oh, I've already talked to my wife. And, you know, and she's agreed that, yes, you can be my second wife. But, and I just said to him, I don't even like the look of you. Why would I want to be your wife?
How did he react to that? Not too well, I'm guessing.
No, not too well, but, you know, I didn't really care. But, yeah, but, you know, when you're in that cult and they get you when you're really young, you know,
And you're saved and everyone else is going to burn in flames.
Yeah,
yes.
And so you see the leader of the group as kind of a prophet-like figure. And so, but I don't know, for some reason, I think my grandparents or someone was with me to say, hey, look, you know, this man is not right. There's something really terribly wrong about this man. And that's when I started to question, you know, because about his behavior and some of his actions and things like that. And then I sort of thought, no, it's time for me to leave.
Narita, what did make you leave? Was it that proposal that you become his concubine?
That was the main one that actually made me leave, but it was also the demands and the pressure that, you know, of the group on us, on women, you know, to be not only nurturers and carers, but also looking after, you know, cooking and everything else. And I think, and the lack of respect I found.
You were asked to cook a gigantic feast for someone. Tell me about that story.
Well, I was, we actually moved from Cairns and went down. I went with, well, Daniel Hallelujah asked me to come with him and his wife, and we had another man called Solomon. We all went down to Marrickville in Sydney. And his wife was heavily pregnant as well, and his wife had the baby. You know, normally all the women of the Jesus people have their babies at home, and they have like a midwife there. So when that day his wife had was, you know, started going into labor at about 10 o'clock at night, and I remember, because I had my two little children, and I remember I was, you know, really tired and about to go to bed, and the wife went into labor. So I went and, you know, helped with the wife, and the midwife came and stuff. And so I was up with the wife all morning, because she didn't have the baby until about 3 in the morning on a Sunday morning. And after I was like, you know, getting ready now to go to bed, and Daniel comes in and goes, oh, I'm going to the Syrian Orthodox Church, and I'm going to invite people from the church to come and celebrate the birth of my child. And I want you to cook enough to feed 60 people, including children, and have it ready by 1 o'clock. So I did do it. I got everything, because, you know, when the leader of the group tells you to do something, you don't question it. You just do it. You know?
So you got to bed. You were about to get into bed at 3 a.m. and you were ordered to knock up a feast for 60 people and have it ready by lunchtime.
Yes.
Essentially.
Yeah, and so
you did it?
Well, it wasn't my kitchen rules. But I cooked the food. I cooked all the food, and so when they come, we all lie down on the they sit down on the, like, they put like rugs on the floor, and people sit on cushions around, and that's how they eat and put all the food down. So I had all the food ready. Then I was supervising all the children. There was a like table with some kids sitting there, and I had to look after them and make sure that they were eating, because a lot of them were under the age of 10. And then I had my two little ones also that I was trying to feed as well. And then one of the member of the group, Solomon, says to me, asked me to make Turkish coffee. You know, he makes beautiful Turkish coffee. And I said, look, I can make instant coffee for everyone, but I won't make Turkish coffee because these are Turkish people, and I don't want to insult them in any way, you know. And but he kept on asking me. He said, look, you know, make coffee. And then after the third time he asked me, and I was so tired and hadn't slept and was looking after all the children, I'd done all the cooking and everything, then I just said, look, why don't you get off your backside and make the coffee yourself? And that's such a no-no, because we do not say that.
So what did you do once you decided to leave? You had kids, as you say. What did you do? Where did you go?
Well, actually, after that conversation, because, you know, you, as I said before, you never say no to the men in the group. So the next morning, you know, after I'd cleared up the day, washed up all the dishes, put everything away,
and
went to sleep.
Yeah, helped the dear leader's wife give birth to a child, yes.
Home, in the house. Mm-hmm. Then Daniel approached me, and Daniel said to me, Solomon told me what happened yesterday, and if you had done this to me, I would have rebuked you first, and he pointed his finger at me like that, I would have rebuked you first and then knocked you down later. And I just said to him, I said, you're lucky, Daniel, that I'm a woman. I said, if I was a man, I'd only have to not hit you once and you'd go down and you'd never get up again.
Where did you find the courage to say that?
I was holding my son, my little son. Then he starts like pushing me and then starts wanting to box with me.
While you're holding your son, he's trying to push you around.
Especially because I said to him that I would knock him down if I was a man, that he wouldn't get up. And so I ended up just walking out. I grabbed my daughter and my son, and we went out to the local telephone box. Luckily, my husband's grandmother, she actually gave me her phone number when I was with my husband when I was young, and we went to Sydney. And I always carried her phone number because she was such a beautiful, friendly, lovely, warm person, and she always very welcoming to me. And so I went to the telephone box in Marrickville, and I just rang Nan up. I said, look, Nan, I'm leaving the group. And Nan's like 80-something, and she just went, yippee, like this. And I said, oh, but Nan, I don't have any money, because in the group, none of us own any money. We all had a common purse. Like, everything we earned went into a common purse, and Daniel held the purse. So I made a reverse charge call to Nan. And then Nan said to me, where are you living? You know, and I said, well, I'm at Marrickville. And she said, you know, tell us the name of the street. And she said, go back to the house, collect your bags. A taxi will be waiting for you. And the taxi will take you straight to Campbelltown.
She saved you, yeah. Really?
Yeah, because I didn't know anyone in Sydney. And so I just, when I went back to grab my stuff, and because we only had a medium-sized backpack, I only had a little backpack and I had a duffel bag with my children's clothes in. So I only had two belongings and I just grabbed my kids. The taxi was waiting out there for me. And as I was walking out, Daniel Hallelujah says, oh, please don't go, rah, rah, rah. And he was just going on. And I just said to him, I said, listen, Daniel, I said, I know one day we have to stand before God. And I said, I will only answer for myself and my children. I said, but you will have to answer for everybody else that you've deceived in this group. I said to him, you know, I doubt whether you're going to end up in heaven. I said, the devil will be waiting for you at the gates of hell with the pitchfork to fork you and throw you in.
And how did that go
and
over?
And then I just walked out. I didn't even look back. I didn't look at his face, and I haven't looked back since. I jumped in the taxi and went straight to Nan's house.
Conversations with Richard Feidler. Broadcast, podcast, and online.
Today I'm in conversation with the amazing Dr. Nerita Morsu Diop. Recruited into a religious cult when she was a teenager, went on there and through a chance encounter took up study and is now a PhD in criminal justice and social work. Now you had two kids with you, your two kids.
My little boy was just starting to walk and my daughter was probably about nearly three. My little boy, I don't even know if he was walking. He was already just, you know, crawling a bit, but he was not very big at all.
So, Nerita, how hard was it for you to integrate with the outside world after that, since you'd been cloistered, really,
Well, Nan and Pop, they were wise people. They were, you know, in their 80s, and they had lived a life, you know, and so Nan was the one that took me down to Centrelink and got me to apply for single parents' benefits, and she kind of talked to me about what I needed to do, because, you know, I wasn't even listed with, you know, Centrelink or anything like that. And so Nan helped me with all of that, took me down. Like, she's just so elderly, and yet she sort of walked me down to the Centrelink offices in Campbelltown and just sort of did everything, helped me with everything and stuff. And so I stayed with Nan and Pop for 3 months until I was strong, like, in my spirit and stuff. And, you know, and they just fed me up, looked after me. They were just the most beautiful people on the planet. And then when I got strong enough, now I said, Nan, I've got to go home. I've got to go back to Queensland. I said, I can't live down here.
So where did you go?
So I went to my cousin. My cousin was married to a school teacher and they lived in Mullaney.
In the Sunshine Coast hinterland.
Yeah, and so I went there and I stayed in a little caravan park. There was only 7 caravans and it was called a Sunrise Caravan Park and was run by Jim and Tina McChrystal.
Now, why did you enjoy living in that caravan park so much, Nerita?
Well, I really enjoyed it because I'd come from a commune where I lived with all these people, and I really loved having people around me. So when I was in this caravan park, you know, I loved having, you know, the community around me, and also when I would cook, I didn't know how to cook for just two people, just myself and my two little kids. I would cook lots and lots of food, and then I would end up inviting all the people from the caravan to come and eat. So then we made a regular thing, so someone would have some food at their caravan and we'd all go there, and then someone would have it at their caravan. So we kind of had this little community thing happening.
That's lovely, though. That's really nice. So it sounds like it's perfectly happy. Tell me about now that chance meeting that changed your whole life.
Yeah, well, when I moved from Mullaney down to Brisbane and stayed with my cousin in Hillend. But as I was walking home one day, walking home from the city, and I went through Boundary Street and I came to this African, it was a craft shop and a music shop, and I could hear this music that I wasn't familiar with. And I'm thinking, oh, this is really nice music. And I looked through the window and they had this beautiful African crafts and everything there. And I sort of went into the shop and I met Tunde and Ade, the name. They were two Nigerian men and they were the ones that were actually selling all the stuff. And when they first saw me, they thought I was Ethiopian. And they said to me, oh, are you from Ethiopia? And I said, no, I'm from Torres Strait. And they said, where's that? So I kind of drew them a little map. This is Torres Strait. And then they, then while we were talking, I was there for about an hour just chatting with them. And then Tunde says to me, "Look, you know, there's going to be this, the African students of the University of Queensland are having a fundraising dinner dance at International House. And they're really welcoming everybody to come. Would you like to come? You know, it's always a lot of fun. There's a lot of new food and music and stuff." And I said, "Oh, yeah." I'd love to come, but I don't have any way of getting there. I have no transport. Then Tunde said, "Oh, don't worry, my friend and I will come and pick you up. You know, don't worry about it." And so they asked me, you know, the following week they came and picked me up and took me out to UQ. And because, you know, I had this inferiority complex, it was really amazing for me to see these African students being all University of Queensland students, because I thought only rich non-Indigenous people went to uni and smart people. I didn't realize that. Like, for me at that time, the university was such a taboo area.
Right, it was a cultural thing for you. It was like, you know, it was only white people that had the kind of cultural connections that would allow them to be in a university.
Exactly, having the intellect as well. Because I never saw myself as smart or anything like that, or having kind of...
Did you think white people were inherently smarter than the Indigenous people back at that time? Did you?
Well, my grandmother did say to me when I was really young, you know, when you grow up, marry a white man because they are smarter than us. They are cleaner than us, and they live in all the good houses.
Yeah, well, you outsmarted your cult leader, didn't you?
She didn't say they're smarter than us. Yeah. What she said was, you know, they're very smart people and they're very clean people and they live in all the good houses and they have all the money.
Mm. I suppose, you know, it's not a long step from saying they're the people who know how to make the culture work for them to think that somehow they're smarter, I suppose. So this was a real shock for you then to see these African students
who were black
prospering at university.
And while I was at this dance, then I met this, I met many, many students, but one of the students stood out to me because of the things that he said. He was actually a PhD student.
And where was he from?
He was from Sierra Leone in West Africa. And I was just talking to him about, you know, like, what he was doing, what he was studying and stuff. And then he started telling me, oh, he was doing a PhD and stuff. And I thought, oh, what's a PhD, you know? And he started explaining all of that, you know, what was entailed, what does a PhD entail and all that. And I said, all I could say was, gee, you must be really smart. And he said to me, look, you know, to study at a university level, he said, all you need is common sense, perseverance and commitment. You know, and he said, if you commit yourself and you dedicate yourself, he said, you can achieve whatever you set your mind to achieve. He said, look, I've come all the way from Sierra Leone, way over the other side of West Africa, to your country, to your university to study. How much better can you do? And I don't think he realized at the time, but it actually stood in my mind. It stuck in my mind.
I'm conscious of the fact you've remembered that conversation word for word.
Yeah.
And this took place how long ago, this conversation?
When I was in my mid-20s, I think.
So maybe 20 years ago or so?
I'm 51 now.
Oh, okay. 30 years ago. And you remember it word for word. That's something that's then just stuck in your mind.
Yeah, it's just stuck in my mind.
You need common sense?
Perseverance and commitment and dedication. Because he said, and you just have to commit yourself. And if you persevere, because he said persevere as well, he said you can achieve whatever you set your mind to achieve.
And did you believe that when he told you that?
I'm not sure if I believed that, but it made me really think. It just put the thought in my mind that, because he was saying, if I can do it, how much better can you do? I've come all the way from Africa. How much better can you do? And because I was on welfare, I was a single parent on welfare, because I was divorced at 22 with two children. You know, and I was living on welfare. But I was also delivering junk mail and selling Avon products.
The fact you're an Avon lady. You went from door to door, and
yes, I went from door to door, and I met some beautiful Aussies in their homes and got some really good advice from many of them. And they would all be really expecting me to come. One of them said, "Oh, you know, you should be a social worker. I think you'd make a really great social worker." When she said that, I thought, I didn't even know what she meant. But they used to make cookies and stuff for me and wait for me to come. And, you know, in Avon...
As an Avon lady, your clients used to make cookies for you and wait for you to come?
Yeah.
I think that's lovely.
They would make biscuits, all the elderly ones. And even one lady who lived in this really high Queensland home, and she said to me, "Oh, look, when you decide to build your home," he said, "build a low house. Don't build high house. Always think of your old age." She said, I built this house when I was young, and now, you know, she was nearly 90 and she had problems going up and down the stairs. And she said, so when I built my house, I built a low brick house.
How did you find your way into social work then?
Well, actually, funnily enough, I actually wanted to do anthropology. And because I really liked, you know, learning about people and from the different cultures and you know, their countries and stuff. And but it was a lady from the administration building from UQ admin. And so I went to put in all my applications and I wanted to do anthropology. And she said, look, Narita, you might not be able to get a job. You know, she said, you know what would be really good would be social work. At least you can study anthropology. They're all electives of social work because social work is a people profession. And you have to do these other, you know, these subjects, you know, as part of, you know, social work. So anthropology, sociology, psychology and all of those. And so she said, you can still do your anthropology, but you do it and then, but you get a Bachelor of Social Work because, you know, you'll be able to get a job, you know, as a social worker.
Given that you'd left school when you were, I don't know, what, 15 or something? Or maybe younger?
Yeah,
I don't
15.
Know.
Well, we only went to grade 10. We didn't have grade 11 and 12.
Yeah, so given that did, how did you find that practice of going to university and studying social work? Because there's a whole lot of language that's used that might have just not been there for you. And English is your second language.
Yeah, English is my second language. But like when I first went, because at the time the social work school was not, it was a faculty of social work and social policy, and we had a dean. And when I applied, I met with the dean of the faculty, Chris Brown. I think he was the dean or the head of school, but I think, yeah. And but he said to me, look, you know, he said, because, you know, you only went to grade 10 and you've got a diploma in secretarial studies, he said, look, he said, what we're going to do is I'm going to let you stay for a semester, and if you pass, you can stay. If you don't pass, we're going to have to send you to TAFE, and you've got to do a bridging course and come back and stuff. And so he let me through. I was enrolled in the School of Social Work. And then, but when I stayed, I actually, the assignments was about life, you know, because social work is about life. And so, and I had, you know, lived, even though I was only 28 years old when I started my, because I enrolled when I was 27, 28 when I started, I had lived the life of many people, you know, who were probably way, way older than me, you know, because I had lived in the cult. I was from an island and I was a single mum and I was a divorcee, you know, and so I had, you know, all these life experiences. I'd helped deliver three babies before I was 22 and things like that, you know, one in a shed, one in a tent and one in a house. So I had all this wealth of experience as for someone so young when I look back now. And so I was able to write about my life. So when they talked about clients with problems with children, I would think of the problems I had were having with my kids and all of the issues and the struggles that I had. And so, and also being Indigenous, you know, because we're, you know, disadvantaged and stuff. And so I could think of my situation, the situations of my own family and own community and stuff. And so I was able to really, and I passed.
Did you? It sounds like you had this really lovely sense too of stretching yourself when you really find yourself being challenged and you can actually sort of do it and you're going further and new worlds open up for you. Was that what it was like, or am I exaggerating here?
Yeah. No, I always, you know, thought, you know, like, you know, opportunity only knocks once, you know, sometimes. And so you've just got to take it and grab it and go with it. You know, it doesn't matter, you know, if at first you don't succeed, you know, try and try again, you know. And those were the things that I've always kind of just kept going, I guess. And, you know, and but I had the love and the support of all my aunties, and there's some really significant people in my life that actually, you know, lifted me up and just, so I stand on all of their shoulders, you know.
So you practiced as a social worker for a while, Narita. How did you take to that? I don't know how social workers do what they do. I mean, you go into really terrifying situations and you've got to try and make sense of it, don't you?
I graduated in 1992 and was a young social worker and stuff. And my first job was working with, we had a grief and loss family support program.
Is an Aboriginal suicide in custody, does that have a contagious effect? And is this why you're doing that kind of work? Is it when one suicide occurs, it tends to spark similar ones? Is that what happens there? And is that part of your work in that kind of role?
Well, I can't say in that sense, but I know that a lot of the issues that people face through because of colonization and dispossession and stuff, that leads people on to suicide and other serious,
despair.
Despair and social problems and things like that. And that's one of the things that I noticed because part of our role was, supporting families who had lost a loved one through a death in custody, in the prison or in police custody. And part of our role was working with them in their journey of grief and then just helping them as much as we can.
Did that come naturally to you, or was it a real challenge, Narita?
I think the challenge was that I it's such a sad area, and the challenge came to me was just like not really understanding fully the impact of grief and the impact of loss, and as a young person, so I actually went and requested to do grief and loss training. I went to the manager of my organization and said, "Please, look, we need to do loss and grief. Our team needs to do some grief." And so we did. We were trained by, really good grief and loss organizations.
And when you're when you're doing that kind of work, is what you do more important than what you say? What do you do?
I guess it's the action. It's the action. It's like, and I found that what I found was that the families that we worked with were not only grieving for the loss of their loved one in prison, but they also had all these multiple issues of unresolved and intergenerational loss, grief, and trauma.
But you can't fix that, can you?
No, we were trying to kind of support them and help them in that, walking with them with that as well as like trying to look at, what happened with their son or daughter that committed suicide, but also, trying to work with them in that other area as well. People just had no way, like some people, found the situation was just hopeless, especially some of them had lost multiple children in custody and stuff. And not only in custody, multiple suicide as well, yeah.
So how do you walk beside someone who's been through that?
I guess every journey, everybody's journey is of grief is very, different, and every family is different. I guess one of the things that I've tried to do is just letting people know that we're there, and we don't often have the answers, but we have a shoulder and we have an ear, and we try and get them to do stuff like something physical to get to deal with the emotional pain. Creating memories for their loved one and stuff like that, either planting trees or telling their story through pictures and all that kind of stuff. We try to get them to do other things to help them, to walk with them. Because, time doesn't heal. What time does is it helps you find a comfortable place. Because you will always remember the anniversary, the deaths, you will always remember, and the trauma, you will always remember that. And I think in the despair of colonization and the impact of colonization and the despair that's brought to people as well, just looking around is a constant reminder that people don't no longer have their land, or they no longer have, some of them don't even know where they came from or where their families are, because they were taken away, when they were babies or when they were children and stuff like that. So there's, and all this stuff that was going on, we found that was really raw. But I guess the thing that actually made me go and look at this area, look at doing my PhD, was I worked for, the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Legal Services.
Yeah, now tell me about that work and what you started seeing when you started working for the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Legal Service.
And one of the things I found was that, because we worked with all the men and women in prison, like from Woodford right down to Nambour, and part of my role as a criminal justice social worker, I guess, was just, helping them, supporting them, not only providing counselling and support, but also helping them, in terms of representing them, sitting with them when they went and faced a parole board, reading their letters to them, helping them with the parole application, but also when they received a letter from corrective services, we would be there to sit and just because many of them, had very limited numeracy and literacy skills, and because many of them, some of them only went to grade 7. And so then they couldn't understand a lot of the words, corrective services would send letters like, "Your remissions is coming up, but we're thinking of not granting you your remissions because of this, and this, and this particular problem."
And they wouldn't know what that list was.
No, and they wouldn't. Well, they wouldn't have been able to understand it. And they said, "Oh, you've got 2 weeks in order to respond back to us to answer these issues that we've raised." But we also monitored their progress as well, how they were going through the system and stuff. And because part of their sentences, they have to do prison programs and rehabilitation programs. And so when one of the things that after they do the programs and then their progress is then reported or recorded in a sentence management review. And what I noticed was, because I would often get all their files, all the information, and when I was looking through the sentence management reviews, I would see, you know, how they fed in the programs. I would see words like the facilitators of the programs would write stuff like lacked interest, did not participate in group discussions, was quiet during group processes. And I would I remember asking them, you know, what happened here? You know, why weren't you interested, or why did this happen and stuff? And one of them said to me, look, you know, he said, look, I wasn't angry until I did that bloody anger management program, you know. And the other one said,
what made him angry? What was it about that? Was it
he said he didn't like the program. He said the program, you know, like because the stuff that they bring up in the programs, he said it just really made him really, really mad. He said, I wasn't angry until when I did that program. That made me real more wild. Another one said to me, look, you know, I didn't like it when they asked me the question, have you ever seen your mother naked in the shower? You know, what has my family got to do with my crime and stuff like that? You know, and another one said, look.
I'm really shocked. Are they trying this cheap Freudian stuff?
I don't know.
On prisoners, Indigenous prisoners?
Yeah.
That's just strange.
And another one said, look, I didn't understand all those big Miglu words. You know, like, I don't understand them words because I only went to grade 7. You know, I don't understand. Another one said, you know, I didn't like it the way we were discussing our real intimate stuff with like complete strangers. So they didn't like the whole way the whole thing was run.
So the programs made them feel stupid or embarrassed, in other words.
Yeah, yeah. Or they didn't understand, simply didn't understand. Because in order for you to progress to the system, you have to show that you've completed this program, you know, there's the sexual offenders treatment program, there's the cognitive skill program, there's also the drug and alcohol program, there's all of these programs that you've got to do in order for you to progress to the system, to show the public, I guess, and to show corrections that you've basically addressed your offending behavior. Basically, this is when I was working there, you know, you know, because that was from like 2000 to 2004. But one of the things that really pushed me to go and look at this area, like and to do research in this area, I guess, was when I met a mum in the residential part of the women's prison, who then asked me to check on a daughter of the same prison in the same prison.
So she was in prison and she wanted you to check on her daughter who was in the same prison?
Yeah, in the detention unit of the same prison. And then when I came back from seeing the daughter, she then said to me she had 5 sons who were also incarcerated. You know, and I was thinking, I'm a mum, I've got 4 children. It would be like me and all of my children all incarcerated. Something's terribly wrong here. How can 7 members of the same family all be in prison?
Did you visit any of her sons?
Yes, I went to visit. I've managed to visit one of the sons. And I remember when I went to see the son, they had him shackled and he had also he was handcuffed in the front and he was just shuffling along to come and he was walking into the visits area. Because when I was working with people in prison, I actually didn't go to the outer area of the prison, to the periphery where the visits area, I actually go inside where they live. So I go inside the different secure units where they live, like, and I sit there with them and talk to them and stuff. But I remember anyway, he was walking up, he was shackled and he came up. But he had his head hung low and down the whole time. He didn't look up. And when he was walking in, and I was thinking, what do I say to him? But he walked up and he came and he sat directly opposite me and he still had his head down. And then the only words that came out of my mouth that I could think of that came out was, "Mum sent me." And when I said, "Mum, send me," he sat down, he was looking down and he looked up and water rolled down his eyes and he said to me, "How's my mum in the women's prison?" He said, tell Mum that I love her and I think about her and I wonder how she is." And I said, "Oh, Mum told me to tell you that she loves you too and she's, you know, hope you're doing okay." And I remember, you know, at the end of that session with him, when he went, you know, I just felt so sad, you know, and I guess I was a little bit traumatized by that too. And that was actually, again, near one of the turning points that pushed me to go and actually look at this area.
So this is part of the research that became part of your PhD?
Yes, that was the research that became my PhD, yes.
And you went to New Zealand to see, what did you see there? This is looking into the incarceration of Maori men?
And women. Well, I wanted to get into the women's, you know, talk to women as well. And I did talk to a couple of women. I wanted to look at New Zealand, not because I want to bring Maori programs here, But I'd heard that New Zealand people would using culture as rehabilitation.
And they what does that mean, using culture as rehabilitation of prisons?
Well, for example, they've got parts of the prison, in New Zealand prisons, I think, well, when I was there, there was like six prisons in New Zealand had what they call a Maori focus unit. And at the part of the prison is set aside for Maori inmates. But it's not just for Maori inmates. Anyone can go there, but there's a long waiting list. And what they do in there is they've got elders working in there. And you can see you're walking into a Maori environment. They've got like their carvings and everything, and they have the traditional foods. Their drug and alcohol program, whatever program is run in a totally Maori way. What they do is a lot of the emphasis is about taking people back to before the drugs, before the alcohol. Because, a lot of people in prison have been in there for drug and alcohol, and minor offenses, especially Indigenous people. And so what they do is they take them right back to before the drugs, before the alcohol. What did our ancestors do? How did they live? And they get them to respect the role of women, and especially those that had like DV stuff against women and stuff. And they just take them right back and get them to sit back and look at, what their ancestors taught them and what their ancestors brought. And one of the guys said to me, he said, I've had 19 years of recidivism, going in and out of prison. And he was like, nearly 60. And he said, I've been coming in and out of prison all this time. He said, being in the Maori focus unit just helped me. They put a human face on me. And they made me understand that, yes, I am somebody's son. Yes, I am somebody's husband. Yes, I am somebody's grandparent. He said, made me value myself as a human being. We need to start building fence, because building fences at the top of the cliff, because we're often the ambulance at the bottom of the cliff. We have this ambulance at the bottom of the cliff approach, and now we need to start building fences at the top of the cliff, if we want to catch people,
Narita, yeah. It's been so fascinating following the amazing twists and turns of your life. It's been such a pleasure having you on the program. Thank you so much for being my guest.
Thank you very much, Richard.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.